You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Jack, tell me a story.
And one time...
The kind of story we need right now.
Welcome back to Tell Me on a Sunday podcast. It's me, Grace Aki. I hope you're doing okay. I hope that you know, intro into season two didn't completely turn you off from listening. Thanks for sticking around. Thanks for being here. I've missed you. I've missed you a whole lot, and I'm glad that you are welcoming me back into your ears. And there are so many episodes from season one that did not get put out due to, I'm just going to mention the other episode of this season. That's kind of why it ceased for a minute, and so I'm excited to put some out that are almost like a year and a half old at this point, but hopefully... it won't be too dated. This one is actually pretty fresh. It's certified Rotten Tomatoes, very fresh, this interview that I got to sit down with just the incomparable Mason Alexander Park, who, if you don't already know about them, they are literally blowing it up. I mean, you could have seen this a mile away. If you're familiar with their work, starting, you know, well, for me, it was, you know, recognizing them through Hedwig and the Angry Inch, the national tour. I knew this person was very special. And then shout out to Jonathan Demar for posting so much about Mason and their Green Room 42 show. And I thought, who is this person? I'm going to have to stalk them on social media. And then we ended up stalking each other. It was great. And I'm just so excited for you to hear all about them. And they're not going to promote their stuff because I told them that I would already talk about it here. And I just want you to put on your radar, if you're not already a big fan of Cowboy Bebop, the live action version of Cowboy Bebop, the anime show, it's coming to Netflix and it's going to be amazing. And they're also doing The Sandman, also brought to you by Netflix. And you got to follow them on all their social media accounts. Follow them at Mason Alexander Park. Pretty simple. I appreciate that it's cut and dry. But yeah, they've got so many great projects coming up. I'm excited to see them in the Pansy Craze. Their Green Room 42 show coming up at the end of this calendar month, the end of Pride Month, thank God. And yeah, I hope that you're having a good week. New York is finally starting to feel... like home again. You know, I went back to my home in Georgia for a long time, and then I was crashing at a friend's house because they were gone in Brooklyn, and then it took me a very long time to be able to have the means to get an apartment due to a lot of like financial, legal, all of the unfortunate adulting costs that came with the pandemic for me. So if you had to deal with any of that, I'm already sorry, and I feel for you, and I understand. And you know, I was very nervous about abandoning New York for the longest time, but I wasn't abandoning it. I had to go. I could not live here. And I was so excited to be back because it's beautiful, and I've missed eating mussels and sitting and talking with people in the face because I've been so careful, and now we're all vaccinated, hopefully, and it's good. It's getting to be really good, but also if things are still kind of bad, I get nervous all the time. I posted this thing on my Twitter that, you know, I feel still scared a lot of times. I'm so excited. Like I wanted to plan this like dinner date, and I wanted to, you know, I'm meeting my friends. And then I thought, what if I have a panic attack on my way? Like, what if I can't do it? And, you know, it's happened a couple of times. I was inside of a restaurant for the first time and in Hell's Kitchen. And I was like, okay, people are so close to me. And I don't know if I can be this close. But you know what? I've got to trust it. You know, they scanned people for their temperatures at the door, and they're checking their vaccine cards. And I gotta, if I'm going to do it, it's going to be okay. And it's okay to not be okay. But yeah, I just want you to know that you're not alone if you're feeling 100 different things. And I deal with my own bipolar 2 disorder on top of all of this pandemic, so I really can't pinpoint it to being like, oh, this is something I normally deal with, thanks Lexapro, or if it's just what happens when you live through a global crisis. Who's to say? I will say, I'm excited to talk to Matt. I will say, I'm excited to talk to Mason Alexander Park today, and I know you're going to want to listen to this. So here are some stories brought to you by my friend, Mason Park.
And the children of the moon was like a fork stuck on a spoon. There was pots and pot of pot done of pasta. The origin of life.
Here we are. I'm so excited to sit down, face to half of my face, with Mason Alexander Mia Thermopolis Ronaldo Park. This has been... I've wanted to talk to you for so long about so many of these things, so it is an absolute honor that you are sitting down for this storytelling podcast. How are you? How are you doing, Mason?
You know, I am doing okay. I am a tad bit... overwhelmed. I don't know. Some of it might have to do with like the real world. Some of it might have to do with the world inside my head. Who knows?
Yeah.
So many things. But yeah. I'm doing really well. I mean, like, there's not a lot to complain about. I am just very, very happy to be healthy and be functioning and able to sometimes get out of bed. And it's going okay.
I appreciate that you said sometimes getting out of bed, because I am telling you, I was not giving up my big ass king size bed for nobody. And because I live there now, that's what I'm trying to say. Like, yeah. Days when I'm just physically not getting out. And I know, like, this sounds TMI, but I know you've seen my bedroom. Like, it's all dark right now. And it's like, it sounds like absolutely sketchy, but you know what I'm saying? Like, it's so dark and just like, you know what, if it's a sad day, it's a sad day. But if it's a good day, I'm in here. So whatever.
It's hard to get out of that hole sometimes. That's what she said.
Yeah.
That's what they said.
That's what
but
they
it
said.
Is. That's
So in absolutely stalking you, just because I'm like so familiar with a lot of like what you do and who you are now, because you are so transparent with a lot of things on most of your social channels, which I find really empowering and also like really beautiful. But I did some deep diving because I want to start at the beginning of your life, bitch. Okay. I kind of knew, like, you grew up a child starlet in a way. Like, you starting, I mean, not even starting, like starting at, you know, age 5, going into iCarly later. Can you just tell me a story about, like, kind of, because I think you do have like a memory of first being on stage and all that good stuff. Like, can you tell me a story about how that kind of came to be for you?
Like, first time ever? Okay. I definitely, the very, very, very first time that I ever was on stage in like a theatrical context was my parents. They really liked trying to get me to try new things. And so they put me in a lot of different activities as a kid, like every sport you can imagine, every random extracurricular that they could get me to take. It was definitely a really great thing, but also, you know, like I felt like I was just trying to balance so many different things. And I guess they had picked up on my obsession of like film and the fact that I had this very weird idea that I was going to grow up to either become Stan Winston or Steven Spielberg. Like, I was obsessed with Jurassic Park and Jaws and like the animatronic aspect of it, like the creature creation part of. I would sit and just like watch these like special features for all those movies over and over. And so I loved I don't know. I like the creative process of making film. And I think they just sort of picked up on that and thought that maybe they would put me in like an acting summer camp. And we were living in Texas at the time. And I went to this place called the Magic Theater in San Antonio, Texas, right down the street from the Alamo, very apropos. They did themed camps where you based on your age group, you could pick different themes and you would basically be in that camp for a week and create a show or a play, you know, an original work based on whatever that theme was. It seems very illegal, although maybe it's covered under parody law, but like basically we were doing like Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter, like whatever it was these massive, you know, these massive books or movies that you would then base your play off of. And so my very first one was Lord of the Rings, and I played the Witch King, which honestly should be my drag name.
I was literally about to say, where's that show in Green Room? Witch King.
Yeah. And that was like, that was the gig. I loved that. My first time on stage is playing, you know, like a villain in Lord of the Rings. And now that seems to be the kind of track that I continue to play into my adulthood. So I'm very grateful for the Magic Theater for really telling me what my type was early on.
Oh my God. You're like, I've been typed. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. Still learning my queer identity, but thank you for typing me as the Witch King. That's really beautiful.
I mean, that is just inherently so queer. The Witch King. Like
the
that
Witch
is just,
King. Yeah.
That's as queer as it gets.
Title of Ep, Witch King. I didn't also realize that you were a Texan. Because I'm a Georgian, and I did not hear that coming out of your voice when I first heard you.
Oh, thank you. I trained it out of me. No, I moved around a lot, but I always lived in the South. Like, I was born in Virginia, and that my dad, for his job, you know, we had to sort of relocate a lot. And so his side of the family lives in North Carolina. So I spent 4 or 5 years, you know, there. And then also in Texas is where my mom's side of the family is. So we kind of hopped around to a lot of different, hotbeds of Southern charm.
That's amazing.
But yeah, I know it doesn't. When I first moved to Los Angeles, people used to say I had a country accent, and I was very confused because I'm pretty convinced I sounded just like this.
Yeah, exactly. Like we all think like, oh, my accent's gone. And like the first I was working in Soho, like when I first moved to New York, and I was like, do you want this in a large or a medium? And then people would be like, your accent. I'd be like, I don't know what you're talking about. Like I would try so hard, but the truth is like, I love everyone's natural voice. And I think it's weird when we try to like, you know, demean people for their accents.
Yeah.
But when you find your voice, that's your voice. You know what I mean? So it is what it is. It has come to me that you are a child philanthropist and still a philanthropist as well. Literally.
God.
Yeah. Like that blew my noodle. Can you tell me a story about like literally channel, I guess like 1 or 9 or whatever it was for the San Antonio News featuring you? I was just like this cherub of a baby. Mason is out here being like diabetes will be cured. I was like, what's happening? Can you please tell me a story? Because this blew my mind.
First of all, how dare you for saying diabetes? I am so mad at you for that. That is, oh God, that really like puts me in a very specific moment in time. Like watching television and that man coming on just being like diabetes every day. I feel like really that did rock my world. So I guess long story short, a really long story short, when I was 5, I think like 4 or 5, whenever kindergarten is, I'm not good with
no,
that.
No, you're right.
The elementary school that I went to in San Antonio participated in the School Walk for Diabetes, which basically provided like little prizes to people based on whatever amount of money you could fundraise for the walk. And then it sort of culminated in, you know, everybody walked like, I mean, a quarter of a mile or something, you know, like on school wearing t-shirts that said, you know, the American Diabetes Association on it or whatever. And that was kind of the whole gig. And so the first year, I mean, I was a very competitive child. I still am a very competitive child, I think. And I raised like $400 or something. I was the top fundraiser for the school. And so there was like an inkling of of, I won some kind of award from the American Diabetes Association, and just sort of like, it sparked something weird in me where I was like, I had a lot of families that were affected by it. And wow, a lot of families. I am, okay, I need help. I had a lot of family members that were affected by diabetes, among many things. You know, good health does not run in my genetics. And I like, it just was something that I cared about and was good at. So the following year I was like, well, I'm going to beat what I did last year. And it was sort of like, I was in competition with myself. And I think the second year I raised somewhere between like $2,000 and $4,000. And, just by like, you know, like asking everyone I know, I would go door to door and take, you know, pamphlets and like talk to people at like, you know, 6 years old. And it was very, very extra. But weirdly enough, like, I think that this is the place that sort of in my life that sparked my comfortability as an actor or as a public speaker or whatever, you know, like it was the first time that I had to learn how to, one, take rejection, like people slamming doors in your face all the time. And two, you know, how to be quick on your feet, how to talk about something you cared about, all of those things. So the American Diabetes Association asked me to be, you know, their ambassador that year. And then eventually asked me to sort of like, go all around Texas giving speeches. Cause I received an award and my mom and I like prepared a 5 to 10 minute speech for me. And they were just like shocked that a child could talk, let alone like, you know, talk at length about.
And you're like, no, this is like what I do. Like, this is what I will do.
Honey, I got this. And so I like, you know, I used to get picked up from elementary school in like a stretch limousine and taken to like the Hyatt Regency to like give a speech in front of like 3,000 business people to try to convince them to, you know, get involved in and help with corporate sponsorships and that sort of thing. And so every year it just like, it got bigger and bigger and bigger. And, to date I've raised a little over, you know, like $100,000 for different charities, the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, the American Heart Association. But yeah, it all sort of like came from, that weird, like competitive spark at 5 years old.
Oh my God. Because you're also like,
I need to do this.
Yeah. And it's beyond the whole, like, you know, you're competing, like, you know, when you're selling like gift wrap for your school and then you're the highest seller or whatever it is. And then you're like, okay, that's cool. But like what you're raising money for actually makes a difference. Like JDRF and like all of those organizations are kind of like great. My dad had type one, I guess, whatever the worst is. My dad had type one diabetes because I grew up, I thought that every dad would use insulin shots. I thought that every single dad like grew up like 3 or 4 times a day shooting their belly. And like, I just thought that that was like very normal. And then I was like, hold on, you have to pay how much for that? Like it kept going up in price and going up in price. And I was like, this is not fun. And in fact, like the other day, my mom broke my heart with a story because I complained that my dad would always serve me, for dessert, he would always get watermelon. And I would get so annoyed because I hate the taste of watermelon. And I told my mom the other day, I would like kind of make fun of my dad or something. I would be like, why doesn't my dad like want to have like real dessert? Like, why did he always like get watermelon? And my mom goes, oh, Grace, that's because watermelon has the lowest sugar in any fruit. So most diabetics, like they eat watermelon. And I was like, well, I'm a bitch. Like that sucks. Yeah. I can't take that back. I wish I had known that. Aww. I was just some child brat, not understanding that that was, you know, something that he had to have. And that happened just the other day. That's why I had to share it. But that's amazing though. And then you kind of carried it out throughout your career and even into now, like you just have that part of you.
Yeah, it's obviously, you know, back then it was the sole focus, and I'm trying to find more time and more ways that I can use, you know, where I am in life to kind of continue all of that work. But you know, it's hard. When you're an actor and you get so preoccupied with yourself and you're like, I need to do X, Y, and Z. And like, you're worried about making your own rent, you know, sometimes it's hard to then be like, let me continue to do all of this other stuff on top of it. So it like definitely took not a backseat, but it was, I've been way less like hyper focused and involved on that aspect of my life. And I'm very upset about it. So I'm hoping that now that things have started to solidify for me, at least scheduling wise and knowing what's next, that I can completely just start, you know, getting back on that horse again and raising money for different causes that I care a lot about.
Well, don't beat yourself up because you do care about it. You know, some people don't give two flying fucks. And that's what bothers me, is that even when they have the means and the ability, they sit on their ass and wonder when does their house free up in the Hamptons? And you don't do that. So I'm just saying, don't
beat yourself.
I will say, if any of our listeners have a house in the Hamptons,
if anyone, please send me the invite.
So like, again, we're not even into like you getting out of your teens. I still want to stay. I want to stay because I need to know more about this like high school theater star that you were. Like, I want to know, were you the one they were like, we're doing the show for you? Or were you the one that was in the back that was like absolutely like mouse hiding? And then one day you just burst onto the scene? Because I feel like there are two types of theater professionals now. They were either in the ensemble, or they were absolutely the Finch in How to Succeed from day one. You know what I mean? Like that bitch.
Dream role. So I was definitely that bitch. Like I was the, I was the kid that they purposefully had to pick a show I couldn't be the lead in order to make people feel like there was no favoritism. And that's like the shittiest thing that I could ever say is that they knew that there were very, very, very few shows that they could do that I wouldn't like get the lead somehow, whether it was a, you know, like a written for a female, you know, written for like, it didn't matter. They knew that there was some chance that I would like somehow snag it. So, there was a year where my drama teacher confided in me, and he legitimately had to pick a show that he couldn't, that he knew I couldn't play lead in. And the show was Dreamgirls, for obvious reasons.
Which
turned out to be so amazing. And I still was in it. I played the Cadillac car track, which was phenomenal. Loved it. Like what a way to go, you know, just come and you sing your one tune. Oh, it's fantastic. No one gives a shit about you. You're just the villain yet again. I probably am the only Mexican person who's ever played that track, I think. I feel like there's no way. There's no way that another person like me has ever played that white track.
Probably. Yeah, no, you're probably right. That's so funny. But I also wonder if like, because you do mention that you have played villains, and I wonder if some of it is like queer-codedness, if it's like, because you know what I'm saying? Like, I wonder if that's kind of a sucky part of it, because I'm thinking you play a villain so incredibly well because you're a great actor. But I also wonder sometimes if we do this to queer people often, like if we're just like, and you, the villain.
Well, I mean, it's sort of been a trope that like has existed since the inception of Disney animated films. You know, it's like really, it is shocking to like go back and watch all those movies and be like, oh, the reason I was so in love with all of these villains was because they are so inherently queer. Like they are queer coded characters from Scar to Ursula. You know, you're like, oh, these are literally the queerest of queers. And it is really, it is depressing at times to think that like the overlap exists and there isn't much representation outside of it, or at least at one point in time, you know, theatrically. Because so many of the characters in like the musical theater canon that are queer beyond like maybe Lacage, you know, I'm talking like pre, you know, the 2010s, like most of those queer characters were kind of villainous unless it was a play, unless it was like, you know, Angels in America or something. So it's, you know, when I think of Frankenfurter, when I think of the MC, like these really very obvious, you know, queer characters that are definitely not the good person, like not the hero. power of the show, but are so much fun to play. So it's that weird combination of like, oh, these were like, this gives me everything that I want as an actor, but what does this say socially about the world at large? And I think we just, to help balance it out, I'm hoping that I will just continue to get to play more, more queer characters that are not nefarious and evil and mischievous and can just sort of exist in a
joy there. You did just mention that you're playing MC, and I've seen several clips of you doing cabaret, and you did it with Ali Silber, right?
Yeah.
There is so much. I feel like this could be a separate podcast that I could talk to you about, because I remember meeting Alan Cumming like back when he was doing it at 54, and like, just watching, I feel like you could watch the MC and not watch the rest of the show, and you feel like you watch the show, like if they're doing their job. Will we ever get to see you do this again? Like, what is there a recording that we can like put out in the world? Like, what? How did you? I'm sure that you've always been in love with that character. Like, can you tell me a story of that character process for you when you were doing that show?
Yeah, the MC really came into my life at a time where I think I needed to see some semblance of a future for myself as an actor. I remember specifically being in high school and being very disgruntled at the thought that like I would have to wait until I was 40 or 50 to play a part that really felt close to, you know, who I was as a human being. And like the part I'm referring to is Albin and Lacage, like literally was the only rep I could think of as a high schooler where I was like, oh, this is a very like gender nonconforming character that like, I don't know why I'm so drawn to more than just that. Like it was more than just a drag part for me. And there was something, you know, so enticing about it. And like, I can't do that show until at least another 10 to 15 years go by. And so I, from now, so even from then, you know, like 100 years ago, like I was far too young. So I remember Googling, I straight up Googled, like, I don't remember if I Googled like transgender roles in musical theater, if I Googled like gender non-conforming roles in musical theater, but I was looking specifically for any kind of, you know, play or musical that had a character that sort of, you know, toyed with gender. And it was before I had a real deep understanding of, you know, like who I was identity wise. And I, you know, I was just sort of identifying as like a cis person who liked drag and androgyny. And I remember finding a video from Cabaret, and I knew I had seen the movie, like I knew the role and hadn't really thought of it as, you know, explicitly like what I was looking for in sense at the time, and just saw a clip from that, you know, the Roundabout production. It actually wasn't Alan. I don't think it was, I saw Raul singing I Don't Care Much, like on a really crappy bootleg of Raul Esparza doing it. And I was like, this is one of the most incredible things I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. It just was haunting and so beautiful and visually like really, really stunning. And it kind of solidified for me this idea that there might actually be a chance for me as an actor to play parts that felt close to how I felt inside or how I identified, you know, or wanted to identify on the outside. And I just hadn't really seen anything like that up until that point. So I went into a deep dive of like the MC of Hedwig and a Frankenfurter. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, these three parts, this should hopefully get me through like a professional career for at least a little bit. And mm-hmm. maybe they'll write more, maybe there'll be more things like this that'll exist, you know, 10 years from now. But at least I know that like there are three leading parts out there that I could realistically play. And it might be worth, you know, pursuing musical theater instead of just selling my soul to TV and film. Cause that was sort of the dilemma that I was in. Oh. Like I was working, you know, on mm-hmm. iCarly and all these other like Nickelodeon shows at that time, and was at an impasse where I was trying to decide if I was going to go to college for musical theater or if mm-hmm. I was going to not go to school, stay in Los Angeles, and just keep auditioning for TV because wow. I was in like I had a good string.
You were
of
doing
gigs.
It, yeah.
And so this literally that night, like that Google search. Changed the trajectory of the next, you know, at least like 4 to maybe 8 years of my life after that. And so when the part, you know, came to be in this production, you know, it had definitely like crossed my path a few times. It had never really lined up where I was able to either audition for it or available or anything. And so this version of it just sort of like came to fruition, and it was a bit of a dream come true. It was the production itself was so stylistically and visually different than the Roundabout version that it really mm-hmm. allowed me to step outside of that and sort of find new reference points that weren't just Alan, because I felt like I already was, you know, a little too close to him in general, you know, like he's the one person that everyone's kind of compared me to artistically my whole
really?
Life. Yeah, weirdly.
Oh,
well, because there aren't a lot of people like him, you know, that like.
So they just liken you to another person that happens to be very interesting. Yes. That kind of, okay, well, weird.
Yeah, I think that's the way that it is, you know, sometimes for people where you're just sort of like, they have no other reference point of like someone that kind of has been famous for toying with, you know, like literally just that one part. And I mean, other parts, he's definitely bent the rules in a few shows, but yeah, that was always like, I remember even in college, like my senior showcase, that was like the note that I got the most was Alan Cumming.
I also have to say that I think that people do this a lot of times with especially queer people that have great cheekbones. I think that they liken them to other people with good cheekbones. I'm not even joking. Like, tell me I'm wrong. I think that they do that.
I'll take it.
I mean, you're like, okay, thank you. I have good skin.
Thank
next.
You. Please keep going.
We could not be more different. This would not be my podcast if we didn't talk about Hedwig. And that's just the truth of it. I know. And I think that that was kind of one of the first like conversations like quickly that we had of like you doing the show. And like, I think I showed you like my little tattoo of the origin of love on my side being like, this is so important to me. I watched you do it on your, one of the videos of your Pansy Craze concert. And I could listen to it on loop. First of all, you got to cut that album. That's a separate thing. I need you to do that emotionally for me. Okay. But I want to talk about you doing that show because it's so incredibly special. And what you were just talking about with like you Googling what roles could exist for me. And then you made that happen with that national tour. Like, can you tell me a story of your either audition process or like you preparing for that role in any way? Because that's huge.
I got to say, I have a really creepy habit of manifesting everything that I like, all the roles that I've really wanted. You know, those three from high school, I crossed off my list as soon as I possibly could. You know, Desire and Sandman literally started from me tweeting Neil Gaiman, asking if Desire is going to be in the first season. I was like, hey, so weird question, but like, can I play this part really? Like, in, you know, and so it's just sort of, I've been very lucky that I think I have a decent enough understanding of what it is that I do or what it is that I can offer to parts. And and it just happens to line up really well with things that I'm very passionate about. I'm very fortunate in that regard. And so Hedwig was a similar situation where, it was like, it was definitely a defining piece of theater and a piece of film for me in high school. It was one of the reasons I pursued musical theater professionally. And, you know, I had been dying for a chance to do it, but I was in college, you know, when the show was on Broadway, and far too young to, you know, be in the part. There also wasn't a standby. It was only Neil, you know, so Neil insisted on doing it himself. If he was sick, he wanted the show to be canceled, kind of a thing. And so throughout that whole run, they never really had anybody that could have made up for, you know, any sort of performances. They only did seven a week. Like, it was such a specific situation. And so with the tour, it was, you obviously can't do that on tour, number one. And number two, you know, you have to do eight shows a week. So they wanted to make sure that they had two Hedwigs, you know, at all times. And so Darren Criss was gonna start it, and they needed somebody to you know, to stand by for Darren. And I was just graduated college when they announced it, and I was going to New York to do my senior showcase. And so my senior showcase was like, Sunday maybe or something, and they were having an open call for it the next Monday. So I was like, you know what? I'm in New York City. I'm just going to go to an open call for
Hedwig. Shut up. Like, are you kidding me?
I shit you not. This was an EPA for Hedwig and Angry Inch. And I was like, I feel like this will be a great story to tell one day when I do it at like a regional theater in, you know, 5 or 10 years, and I can be like, oh yeah, fresh out of college, I auditioned for the tour like an idiot, thinking I could do this. You know, up until that point, every famous, you know, it was only famous cis men that had played the part, and like obscenely famous.
Yeah, all white except for Tay.
Except for Tay, right. And so there was no indication whatsoever that like it would ever be a serious thing for me. So I went in and the monitor was like, so oddly enough, they're saying you can have up to like 5 minutes of time in the room if you don't, like if you have a full song, you're welcome to do full songs instead of like 16 to 32 bar cuts. And everybody was like, okay. So I went in and I, for my showcase, had put together a Hedwig medley that was like Wicked Little Town and Hedwig's Lament, sort of like mashed together in some Frankenstein-y way. I believe those were those two songs, or I could be completely wrong, but it was cut because it was too long for my showcase. And so I had this like, you know, 3 minute long cut of Hedwig material in my book, and I just sort of gave them the freedom of choice. I was like, I prepared another song, but I think, you know, if you're interested, like I can do a little Hedwig medley. And they all looked at me like I was, you know, an insane person. And they were like, please, please do the Hedwig songs for us. And I was like, okay.
Oh my God.
I pulled up a chair and I sang it for them. And everybody was like, you know, I think pretty unanimously confused and shocked that I didn't fall on, you know, flat on my face, I think. So within like an hour or two, I had a call from my agent saying that they really, really loved me and they wanted me to come back like on Friday or something to do a bunch of material. So they gave me like 10 pages of material. I was like, it was at nine, you know, I was the first in. As I left, there was like famous person after famous person, you know, like in the waiting room in Hedwig drag. And I was like, oh, okay, I know you. I've seen you on TV. Oh, I saw you in Rent. Like,
that's
whatever.
Not intimidating. Yeah. Oh, right, right.
Yeah, no, yeah, like it's not intimidating at all. And so I did, you know, like did the callback for them there. And then again, like I on my drive, I left New York and was driving back to Pittsburgh because I went to college there. And within a couple, like I think it was 3 hours after my audition in the morning, they called on their lunch break and they said, hey, you know, we have no idea what this process is going to look like. We don't know when, you know, we're going to be doing final callbacks, but we just want you to know that like Mason is our top choice right now. And we would love for Mason to come and do a final callback like in a couple of months. And I was like, okay.
Sure. And again, you're probably still like, okay, sure.
Sure. Right. Every time I was like, oh, this is really, really cool to have gotten to this point. This is where it ends. Yeah. And like, how cool that it ends here. Was like never thinking that it was a possibility. It was always about the like, oh, that's great. All right. Well, can't wait to not get it. And so I was working at Pittsburgh CLO at the time. I was doing South Pacific there. And the way that CLO works is they don't do understudies and or anything. And it was the week of shows, because it was only 1 week of shows, was the same week that Hedwig decided they needed me in New York to do callbacks, which were like final callbacks, which were very heavily involved. It was like, we're talking work sessions where I showed up drag. Learned, you know, like I learned choreography from Tear Me Down for like an hour, and I had to then go to a music studio where they had the band there, they had, you know, full mic setup, everything, and I sang it and performed it with full audio, like as if you were doing a show in just a smaller theatrical space. So I literally like go through this process. Stephen Trask is there, like everyone that I've been obsessed with forever.
Forever.
Is like watching me do, you know, like 20 minutes of material from Hedvig. And I'm 20 years old, you know, trying not to show it.
Like you're a damn baby.
A child, like putting on as much, you know, makeup as I possibly can in hopes that they think that I'm older. Because everyone else, you know, like the part, she is an old person. Like Hedvig is, I mean, not an old person, but she's in her 50s,
but she's
according
lived,
to the lore.
Definitely. Yeah exactly.
And so I was terrified that like my age was going to ruin it. And it didn't. They asked me to come back again that Friday. So I flew back to New York and would fly to New York and then fly back to do South Pacific at night. And my flight was canceled on the last day. So I had to call Pittsburgh CLO. And if anybody from them, you know, listens to this, they'll finally know and then they'll kill me. And I had to pretend I was sick. I was like, I'm dying. I'm in a hospital. Like literally had to come up with the most insane lie in order to get out of it. And they sent someone on stage with like a script in hand to, you know.
Wow. That's okay. They're fine. CLO's fine.
CLO's fine. They made their money. They're totally fine. It was unbelievably involved, and I've never been through a process where like I've actually gotten to live with a character in such a specific like intense way, and gotten to show people truly, you know, what you're capable of doing in a non audition context. Like it felt like work sessions, and it felt like performance, and it really gave me a little more opportunity to kind of like live in her bones a little bit. Mm-hmm. That was my whole like beginning to end process. And then they called and said that I got it probably like a week or so after that, I imagine.
They had to let you know. Shock
of the century.
But also, like, what a beautiful experience to have had right after school. You know what I mean? To say, like, this is how I get into this, and this is what collaboration really means, and this is what working is. Because I think that a lot of times people get out of school, and not that I did not go to musical theater school, but I think a lot of times people get out of school and then they go, well, I'm supposed to show up at everything wearing this outfit, and here's my book, and they're just taught all of these like very cookie cutter things. And you seem to have remarkably just like been able to be yourself as well as like being a pro at it. And that's probably just, that's worth more than any paycheck they could have given you on tour. You know?
Truly. Yeah. I am a very fortunate human being in that regard. I don't know what it is, but I feel very lucky to be so close to a lot of these parts and things that are so very specific. And kind of iconic, because it did make me feel like very seen and very taken care of. And also like there would be, hope beyond that one show, or hope beyond, you know, I never felt like I had to conform to an idea of what a musical theater, you know, person who looked or sounded and sang like me had to be. You know, I've always sort of been able to do my own thing, and it's been fortunate enough to have been celebrated and consumed in various ways, which I'm very happy about. Okay.
Hi, welcome back. This is the kind of end of the show where you and I kind of play a game called Short Story, and it's very simple. Don't worry. It's not like you had to have taken an improv class in college to do this. But basically what happens is I'm going to give you a one word suggestion, and then you're going to tell me, it can be a true or false story, but you have to tell me a story in 2 minutes that made you think of that word. You don't have to use the word. Like I could literally say goldfish. And you could tell me a story about how you scuba dove, like, and it doesn't, it's not like you have to tell me a story about a goldfish. And then you are going to give me a word, and then I will tell a 2-minute story. So I can go first with the storytelling, or you can go first, either way.
You can give me a word first. Let's see.
Okay. All right.
I'm nervous.
Mason Park. Your word is wig, and your time starts now.
Oh my goodness. Okay. When I was playing Hedwig, God, so basic, but first thing I could think of, I could do this with every role because pretty much I'm always in a wig. But when I was doing Hedwig specifically, there was so much wigography for anyone who's ever seen that show. There is like, during Wig in a Box, there is that sequence where you are like just taking wigs off, putting them on. And they're all magnetic. They all automatically attach to the base wig that you have on that has like all these magnets inside. And I remember that my first performance of it ever, there's a trashy one that goes on right after Angry Inch ends, and it's like the wig that Hedwig is wearing in the trailer park when she starts the song, and then it comes off and she starts putting them on. And I remember poor Hannah Corneau, who was playing Yitzhak for me at the time, it was our first time doing it together on stage. We had rehearsed it together and stuff, but I guess my height was a little bit different from the Hedwigs before, and she could not yank it off my head. And so it's like there is a bootleg somewhere of like me just Hannah like yanking this thing that's like magnetically glued to my scalp off of my head, and us trying to play it off, and it's very beautiful.
Oh, and you did it in 1.5 minutes. Look at you. There you go. It's funny. Somebody was telling me, like, how on earth does Tina Turner do the Tina show on Broadway? How do they do that with the wigs? Like, she's literally running around with throwing her head. And I'm like, you know what magnets are, right? Like, you know that we've been doing that shit for a while. They're really strong. So that's really funny that you, oh gosh, I could just see it. I mean, I've seen Lena's shoes from when she was Yitzhak for the very end, and they're such tall heels. She's already a tall woman, but I remember just like thinking about like how enormously tall. But then when you're Yitzhak, you're wearing like just boots, right? Like you're just wearing like Doc Martens.
So little combat boots.
Yeah, she did not have any help. That's really great.
Yeah.
Oh, all right, Mason, you are going to give me a word whenever you're ready, and then I will start the time for my 2-minute story.
Okay. All right.
You got it?
Your word. Yeah, I'm looking at things in my room, and I have like.
I saw the wig behind your shoulder, so I went with it.
Very, very smart. Very smart. Okay. Your word is vanilla.
Oh my God, vanilla. Let's talk about men for a second. Why on earth is your favorite ice cream flavor vanilla? I'm not saying that vanilla is bad, but if you're going to go with a vanilla, perhaps go with a vanilla bean. Like even a triple milled vanilla, perhaps. Like, I don't understand the immediacy of being like, I'm at an ice cream shop and these motherfuckers are giving me truffle bamboozled chocolate dick surprise, and you're out here getting vanilla. And I'm just confused. And I'm telling you, if you Google number one male requested scent, it's vanilla. Like you go to, yes, even the base note of most popular colognes is vanilla. If they ever go to the Bath and Body Works, they do request vanilla bean Noel. It is the weirdest thing in the world. It's like an absolute addiction from most cis men. I don't understand. But it's kind of sweet, I guess. Like, it could be worse. I guess it could be cinnamon. Like, cinnamon is lovely. I love a chai, but I don't think that it would be my first top note for a scent. That's what makes me think of vanilla. That's that.
I love that. That was beautiful.
I did it 1 minute.
Well done.
And I'm not even joking. Done. Like, I absolutely subscribe to that. So, big yikes. What did you see in your room that was vanilla?
I have a candle that says vanilla tobacco.
But but the tobacco gives it that dark, like rustic, like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's a good blend. It's from like a dressing room. I'm one of those people that probably, it's very illegal, I think, to light fires in most theatrical spaces.
That's okay.
But I'll burn a candle or two in my dressing room.
I'm currently burning. Oh gosh, I'm going to get up for a second.
Oh no.
No. I wish you could see this. It's lavender and dragon fruit. It's delicious.
Ooh. Ooh.
Yeah. It's very, oh gosh. It's very bright. It's good. If someone has just like ruined your bathroom, you can light it. If your room smells of like debauchery, you can also do that. Like it's really good. It's a really great candle. Mason, I will have talked about your upcoming shows. I will have talked about anything else. Is there anything that you want to impart, either story-wise or things that you are inspired by or advice? Also, you're not held to this, so I can cut it if you're like, I don't have any of that. So you're not sounding like no.
Just but, entirely empty.
Yeah. Is there anything you want to impart today?
Oh God, I have so few words of wisdom for any human being. I don't know what could I say? There's so many things I could say.
Yeah.
But I'm so bad when it comes to like not having a prompt. If I have like a specific prompt, I'm really good at shit. It's for some reason when someone's like, what is the best advice you've ever gotten? My brain completely will like just go numb. I'm like, no. I don't think anyone's ever given me advice in my life.
Well, Mason, what would you tell your younger self? Like if you could go back to like a story when you were a younger person, would you be like, hey, this thing's going to happen. And even your Google search, like this thing is going to happen and it's going to change your life and you're not going to feel like this anymore.
Ooh. Yeah. I mean, if I could go back and talk to my younger self, there are a lot of things that I think all of us would say. I feel like universally, most people would go back and be like, be kinder to yourself or, you know, or something to that effect, which I still probably need to remind myself of even as an adult. Like I need to go back to the person yesterday and say that same thing. But I guess what I would say is your desire to fight labels doesn't necessarily come from a place of not wanting to be seen. It just comes from a place of not having the right words to describe how you feel.
Wow.
I think that's what I would say. Yeah. Cause I spent a lot of time kind of like avoiding questions, avoiding identity as a whole thing, because no one could really understand what it was that I, you know, represented, whether I was a gay cis person, whether I was a trans woman. Like there were just so many question marks in a time where like the rainbow, the spectrum of, you know, human representation wasn't nearly as colorful and as specific and inclusive as it is now. So anytime that I like thought that I got to a place where I was like, oh, this might be what I am or who I am, you know, there were a million people telling me that that didn't make any sense, or a million people that were assuming I was wrong or I was lying to myself or there was something else going on. So I was just like, well, I'm never going to label myself ever about anything. And I'm just going to be this elusive character that like, you know, does their own thing and no one can say anything about it. And that was only because I just didn't have the right vernacular. Like now that I have words to describe, you know, my identity to gender, my identity to sexuality, have an umbrella term like queer that is so universally loved and accepted, you know, in a way that it really wasn't. Like that wasn't an answer back then. You could say it and people would be like, right, but are you, what is that? Like, okay, so but you're a lesbian. You're like, no.
Yeah, right.
I said what I said. And so it's I would definitely go back in time and tell myself that like things are going to change dramatically and that what you're feeling is so valid and a lot closer to how you actually are going to feel in 10 years or 15 years than what you think it is. It's just like the rest of the world has to catch up first.
Oh, yeah, here we are. I'm glad we had a year. I'm not glad for what happened in the year, but I'm glad that we had the year to figure more of ourselves out because there was nothing else distracting us from who we are. And I think that that's true for most people. Also, if you didn't grow this year, fuck off. I don't know what you were doing, but it wasn't good. It wasn't good, folks. You probably were absolutely fine. And for that, I say, fuck you anyways.
Yeah. I actually talked about that on another podcast, like a completely, that was for like a Cowboy Bebop. Sort of podcast situation. And we, for at least 20 minutes in the beginning, just talked about like how much growth happened in the pandemic for everyone. But like me in particular, I've been really lucky to see how many queer people I think found a better sense of stability and a better sense of identity and self-worth without the distractions of like everyday life. You know, a lot of non-binary and a lot of trans people like myself who are visually queer and visually trans, you are constantly reminded when you're in the real world of like kind of how much of an outsider you actually are and how little people respect you and respect your identity. And the sad thing is that like translates so directly to your own view of yourself, to your own self-worth. And so having that year where like you're at home and no one's like really coming into your house to be like, hey, sir, or hey, ma'am, like, you know, and like misgendering you or talking shit to you, is a really liberating experience. And so it wasn't until I started working again, like it wasn't until I went to do Bebop and started getting misgendered, you know, way more frequently, and like, you know, started being in press releases about these about these like massive shows where people are like making fun of pronouns or making fun of trans people or, you know, like that kind of stuff, that like I didn't get hit again with that sort of sense of like, oh my God, I forgot that like the world views me as a freak, as like a problem.
Because your safety changed.
And it's still that way, you know. It's like it's getting worse, and I notice it more and more, and the world's reopening, and it's going back to that, if not, you know, being multiplied, you know, like getting COVID tests. Like I remember getting COVID tests during Sandman, and the and the person that was doing my test, like straight up, like I was there in a little, in like a slip and a blazer, and
oh,
like
it
was
God, really yes.
First time I decided to wear a dress out in like ages, you know, like truly ages. And like first thing out of this person's mouth was like, I hope you're, is that a costume? I hope that's not your real clothes. I hope you're not wearing that outside.
Oh my
God. And I was like, how do you get on? Like you're shoving a stick up my
nose. Stick up my nose.
I like, and talk, and like just being an asshole to me. Where do you get off on sort of like telling me how I can or cannot express myself? Like literally was like, oh, I didn't expect that voice to come out of you. And like, just like could not shut up about the entire interaction was about my, how strange, you know, my presentation or how strange my gender was, how weird it was that I had, you know, lipstick on or like, and that like they were so like, couldn't not talk about it. And I was like, oh, right. This is what being at home, like offered me the chance to kind of not really have to deal with this in real life, just on the internet. And now I have to deal with it on the internet and in real life again. And that is not exciting.
I'm sorry. I'm really sorry, but I'm also like really, I'm really proud of you. Like I just that all of that is really awful, and I hope that it keeps changing. But I think that the more people are educating themselves, that they're supposed to do that on their own, and like, you know, getting better at learning, I hope that it changes, especially for young people, because I don't feel, and again, it's not my story, so it's not like I'm an authority figure on any of this. But I just hope that, you know, one day we're going to wake up and nobody has to announce anything. They can just like go about and they can just say like, oh, this is how I'm identifying and this is how I exist. And then people are like, okay, that's fine. You know, not like I've got to figure that out. Like, oh God,
right. Everyone wants to understand it. Everyone wants, or not necessarily wants to understand it, but everybody wants to be able to control it. It's like, if you don't identify that way, then it's hard for you to fathom why any human being on earth would be anything other than the thing that you are. It's like, the narcissism that exists in this world, especially in our country, is astounding. And that's where it really all just comes from, a place of like ignorance and narcissism, of people being like so confused and baffled by the fact that they might not know everything, or that they, you know, might be privileged, or that they might, like, it's just, it is so weird when people are confronted with, you know, something different and see it as a threat that doesn't involve them, as opposed to just
always threatening. Right.
Right. It's like, oh, well, that doesn't bother me. You know, it's like, what is me being on television, like me being, you know, non-binary, like ever going to do for someone in a negative way that like doesn't identify that way? Like all they have to do is ignore me. Like just don't, you know, that you can not like me or whatever, but don't like judge the reality of, you know, the identity. Don't judge the reality of the fact that like everybody's going to be different from you. Like not everyone's going to be the same, you know, exact boring person. So like, let's just chill.
Pack it up.
And just don't be friends with that person. If you don't want to hang out with a non-binary person, then just like, don't hang out with me. Like,
no,
my God,
it's because
I'm never gonna come to your house and call you an asshole.
No, but I think that it's also this fear of like, well, then if you are so celebratory of who you are, oh my God, what have I been doing my whole life? And what are my kids going to do? God forbid they end up like you. What? And I'm like, oh, sorry. You don't want your kid to love themselves.
Right. You don't want your kid.
That's so weird.
Get to wear fabulous outfits and be cute.
Yes. Oh, God. God forbid. We are doing the Lord's work for the South. That's what we're doing today. That's what this podcast was. And it's funny you even mentioned narcissism, because that's the whole episode before this one is kind of all about that. This was such a lovely conversation. Mason, you have so much to get back to. What a pleasure to sit down with you. And every time there's like a random fucking press release of like, you're doing this thing or like another, I'm just like, yeah, go off. Like, I'm so happy for you. It's been such an exciting year. And I can't wait to watch Cowboy Bebop, because my little Japanese anime ass is going to be thrilled to see it on the screen, and I can't wait. So thank you so much, Mason.
Thank you. Anytime.
Thank you for listening to Tell Me on a Sunday podcast. This has been a That's Gouda Media production. I want to give a special shout out to my Patreon subscribers. That's Triple Threats and Beyond. Daniel, Joe, Abigail, Matt, Caitlin, Carson and Marissa, Joe F., Priscilla, Rick and Margaret, Molly and Norman, Mackie, Violet, and Michael. Merch is going to be released through my Etsy shop. If you don't already follow that, that's at Grace Aki Made It on Instagram. But also you can find it on Etsy, Grace Aki Made It. Lots of podcast related merch, I guess, and by lots I mean probably one or two to start, and all of my other artwork is available on there too. I mean, as artists we do a million things, we're multi-hyphenates. You can still listen to me weekly on Broadway Radio, that's usually Tuesdays through Thursdays. You can get your Broadway news every single day, presented by me, Matt, Ashley, sometimes James Marino. It's really good, highly recommend that you listen to it. Thank you guys again for joining me on this journey of storytelling. I hope to see you next week. Otherwise, stay safe. Love you.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.
If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.